Howdy, folks. Welcome to Weekend Watchlist, a look at what's screening and streaming, brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. I'm Mitchell, he's Slim.
Hello.
And together we'll dig through what's dropping this weekend, last weekend, recent trends on Letterboxd, and we'll also take a peek at our own watchlist, all under 30 minutes, or Slim and I will be replaced by ChatGPT bots. We will not be on the show anymore. That'll be the future of Weekend Watchlist.
It's not a future we want, folks. Mitchell, can you and I be honest with each other right now?
We always are.
This episode is so large that we needed some help to bring it to you. It's brought to you by The Starling Girl, presented by Bleecker Street. A hit at the 2023 Sundance Film Festival, the film stars Eliza Scanlon from Sharp Objects and Little Women as Jem, a 17-year-old struggling to define her place within her fundamentalist Christian community. With the return of Owen, an enigmatic youth pastor, played by Lewis Pullman, Jem finds herself drawn into a dangerous relationship that could upend their entire community.
The Guardian calls The Starling Girl transgressive, and IndieWire says Eliza Scanlon shines. Big talk from some big outlets, but you know what's bigger? What are the Letterboxd community saying about The Starling Girl? Bree says Lewis Pullman and Eliza Scanlon walked onto that set and said they're going to deliver outstanding performances and insane chemistry while looking sexy. And that is exactly what they did.
Abigail left a review. This will be both overwhelmingly cathartic and absolutely brutal viewing for women with a certain kind of religious background. So much effing shame on display here. Like Parmet dug straight to the core of religious trauma and scooped out its broken heart. Phenomenal performances from Eliza Scanlon. Phew! Can't wait to see what Parmet does next.
The Starling Girl opens in New York and LA on May 12th and in additional cities throughout the month.
If I had a nickel for every enigmatic youth pastor I've met over my lifetime.
I think it's part of a requirement for the job, right?
Yes.
Are you enigmatic? No, you're out of
here. Submitting your resume, that's a checkbox you have to hit. So let's kick things off. We're going to talk Blackberry Fool's Paradise, Charlie Day's big release. The Starling Girl, obviously, and your Letterboxd reviews tagged Weekend Watchlist, a look back at last week's movies, and we'll shuffle our watch list to wrap up the show.
Blackberry, directed by Matt Johnson, coming out in theaters from IFC Films. The synopsis for this one, the story of the meteoric rise and catastrophic demise of the world's first smartphone. Big movie coming out. Glenn Howerton, speaking of Charlie Day and Always Sunny, Glenn Howerton playing one of the big wigs with not a lot of hair on his head in this one. Jay Baruchel in it as well, as the two guys kind of running up the BlackBerry scheme. Slim, you and I have both seen BlackBerry. What were your thoughts on this one?
Let me just say this, if I may. Is it too early for the Glenn Howerton Oscar buzz?
I don't know.
Is it too early? I had to shut off my DMs. I'm getting DMs left and right. You hearing about this Glenn Howerton performance? But I grew up and I still am like a big tech news and gadgets person. So I was, you know, following the news when BlackBerry and the iPhone were happening. I didn't even recognize Jay Baruchel at first in this movie. I mean, honestly, you might not even recognize Glenn Howerton.
The biggest arc of BlackBerry for me was watching Jay Baruchel's hair transform over the different, they do a bunch of time jumps throughout.
Yeah.
And every time you do a time jump, it's like, what's his hair doing now? What's going on now? By itself, I'm the opposite of you. I'm not a big tech person. I had an iPhone 5 until like 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. The apps wouldn't even open anymore. They're like, I tried to open an app. They're like, what are you doing? Like, get a new phone. But so for me, I didn't know like any of the BlackBerry story or anything. And I felt like it was interesting getting that kind of behind the scenes history on how it all went down. And there's like a big moment where when the iPhone releases, they have like Steve Jobs' like presentation, which even I like remember that presentation and like know the, you know, the iconic imagery of that presentation. And like you see everybody in the room at BlackBerry watching this presentation, and it just looks like their like lunch just got stolen by the bully at school. Like it is the way that the ball just drops for them is, I mean, you could feel yeah. like the energy of that room.
Yeah. I'm not familiar with Matt Johnson, the director who's also in the movie. We have a video from Matt reading reviews of the movie BlackBerry. Very fun. But yeah, I had a lot of fun watching this. It was so cool to go back and see the the making of BlackBerry. Like, there's so many fun scenes where they're talking about how, you know, the nerds behind BlackBerry, they essentially build like one of the earliest encrypted messaging system. Like, essentially it was like iMessage before the iPhone even existed. It was just kind of cool to see everyone's reaction to that in the movie. But we have some reviews. Luca left a review. The film's biggest surprise is Glenn Howerton, who is truly, unbelievably, absolutely effing deranged. I have not seen a role this menacing, this commanding, this absolutely insane since Al Pacino's performance as Vincent Hanna in Heat. What do you have to say about that, Mitchell? What do you have to say about that review?
I mean, it's a good performance. It's a good performance. I can't knock the performance. Listen.
When you hear Mitchell's voice go 10 octaves higher, that means the political games are happening right in front of you.
I liked BlackBerry. I maybe didn't love it to the extent that you did. People can see my Letterboxd review if they want. But I had a nice time with it. I'll read Zach's review of the film. Who calls it a time capsule comedy, a corporate thriller, and a drama of hubris all packed into one. Matt Johnson's feature is a hysterical, exhilarating rise and fall, punctuated by a dynamic camera that finds the funniest reaction in the room. Lots of hilarious performances, but Johnson as a childlike engineer and Howerton as an executive with volcanic eruptions of anger stand out as tragicomic figures struck down on polar opposite ends of the business spectrum. Glenn Howerton, you know, this time next year, we'll be talking about that Oscar nomination,
yeah,
I'm sure.
That speech is probably going to be amazing. I mean, who would have predicted we'd have two movies out to talk about this week from stars of Always Sunny? Has it ever been done? I don't think it's ever been done on this show.
First time. We're debuting it this week. Yeah. Breaking history.
Yeah, so the second movie we'll spotlight this week is Fool's Paradise, directed and starring and written by Charlie Day. This is going to be in theaters. The synopsis: a down-on-his-luck publicist discovers a recently released mental health patient who looks just like a misbehaving movie star. The publicist subs him into a film, creating a new star, but fame and fortune are not at all what they're cracked up to be. So as of recording, the reviews are embargoed for this movie. So we can't even see any reviews. But Mitchell, have you heard anything about Charlie Day's like big directorial release, or is it what's inspired it over the years?
Yeah, I know people have been comparing it. People who have low-key, I won't spill any names. I won't rat anybody out here. But people who have seen it, maybe Mia, have been comparing it to Being There, the Hal Ashby Peter Sellers movie. I'm seeing a lot of comparisons to Being There for this one. But you actually got to check it out. So what did you think about it?
I watched it yesterday, and so for fans of Always Sunny, I feel like that's probably like the primary demographic. They want to see what Charlie Day can do in like a feature film. I haven't seen Being There, and I heard Mia say that that was like a closest kind of thematic comparison, but it felt like a 60s Jerry Lewis vehicle because Charlie Day doesn't speak in the movie. Like when his mute version of the character appears, he's mute. So it kind of depends on the supporting cast to fall in and kind of lift the movie up. So that felt like a movie that I could have seen Jerry Lewis attempt in the 60s, like, you know, his kind of like physical comedy and stuff. So if that entices you and you're a Charlie Day like super fan, this might be for you. I will say this was not for me. It does depend on the supporting cast to lift this movie up. And I kind of wanted more from Charlie. It's like a Charlie Day vehicle. And I think maybe that might be shocking to some people that like, oh, I'm going to see a Charlie Day movie. I mean, he doesn't speak in it. So you just maybe like set your own expectations for that kind of a movie and then maybe you'll still enjoy it.
I feel like that's a big like first time director kind of move that I respect, honestly, like for first time directors to make it like star in it, use kind of their star power, but then also make it much more about like the people around them and not like, like you can be a first time director, go in and be like, yeah, I'm the star of this movie too. Like, this is my movie. Like, I'm all over this thing. Or you can put the attention on other people. But yeah, I'm a big Charlie Day fan. I've always loved Always Sunny. And I mentioned to you and Mia, I saw Horrible Bosses 2 twice in theaters, which is more a consequence of having divorced parents and like my only interest being movies. So like the only way they could think to spend quality time with me is like, hey, let's go to the movies. Mm-hmm. But I like those Horrible Bosses movies. I like the first one better, but you know, they're fun.
I've not seen any of the Horrible Boss movies.
You should watch the first one and see what you think.
What about Pacific Rim? What do you think about Charlie Day and Pacific Rim?
He is fun. He has sex with a giant monster in the second one, which is an interesting decision.
What more do you need?
What more do you need?
I mean, also, isn't he Luigi in the Super Mario Brothers movie?
Luigi.
What a year for Charlie Day.
big year for
40th season of Always Sunny debuting this year.
That show is never gonna end.
I had no idea that it was still ongoing. I've watched a lot of those seasons. It's an amazing show, but I didn't even realize that it still had the super fans that were still watching.
People won't ever give it up. They can just keep going.
Mm-hmm.
But let's keep going into the third movie we're going to talk about. What is this? It's The Pope's Exorcist? What? Directed by Julius Avery on 14,000 watch lists? Wow.
Get the hell out of here.
I guess we'll just talk
about
it.
Shut it down.
Again.
I'm doing the cut off neck symbol to the studio engineer.
Russell Crowe stars. No. Just we're having fun here. We're going in a different direction, still religious themed in a way. I'm bridging the gap. The Starling Girl, as we mentioned in the ad read at the top of the episode, directed by Laurel Parmet, coming out in limited theaters. We mentioned the synopsis for this one at the top of the episode, so let's get right into some more talk from what the Letterboxd community is saying about The Starling Girl. I've been seeing buzz building on it since Sundance. Letterboxd member and my fave Top Gun Maverick character, Bob Lewis Pullman, getting lots of talk in the reviews of this one. But we've also got a list on our HQ page from director Laurel Parmet, where she told us about some of her biggest influences on the film, including titles like My Summer of Love, Mustang, Brighter Summer Day, the Edward Yang film that I really love. And I'll read quickly what Laurel said. You can check out that list and read her notes on each film that's in the list about like why that film specifically inspired her for it. But I wanted to read what she said about Lars von Trier's Breaking the Waves to give a sense of what The Starling Girl might give viewers. Laurel said, "One of the best and most brutal films about religion and love. The church and the world around the main character is so horrible, but she always keeps her faith. A masterclass in naturalistic performances and in studied nonchalance. The story should be melodramatic, but Lars von Trier keeps it so grounded and intimate, casual seeming even, so that it all feels so real."
Wow. I didn't realize her film debut was 2019 in both Baby Teeth and Little Women.
Yeah, Eliza Scanlon is like blowing up. Eliza Scanlon is like really, she's charting the path. You can look through a lot of Letterboxd reviews that are like, Eliza Scanlon suffering, like this girl needs a break, but also like who can do it better than Eliza Scanlon's been doing it.
Yeah, so before we move on, we'll spotlight a review from Gemma, editor-in-chief, Letterboxd. This is
get her on the pod.
When will Gemma be on? That's the question people are asking. Gemma writes, "Footloose, but with a female gaze, the camera hewing closely to its lead, a focused Eliza in a beautiful layered performance. So far, my Sundance can be best summarized as America hates sex. Here's another example of that."
Wow.
I've seen that also in some reviews. So Gemma, on the show in review form. I think that is the quota. We just met it. So watch out.
We got it right. Well, let's take a quick look back at what films you and Mia talked about last week and see where some averages, you know, some Letterboxd responses are coming in. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, 4.2 average.
Wow.
As you guys mentioned last week, it's still holding on to that position as the highest rated MCU film on Letterboxd. Occam's Chainsaw reviewed it on the site, tagged Weekend Watch List, called it the best one of the series. It really gives me hope for the future of the DC cinematic universe. I'm not sure that was Marvel's goal, but here we are. James Gunn moving over, getting a lot of praise for Guardians. Yeah. Headed on over to DC now.
Yeah, finally. Finally, the DCU getting a handle on things. I also am excited for James Gunn to run the DCU. They get that reset with that Flash movie coming out, and hopefully he's going to do well with the Superman Legacy movie, whenever the heck that comes out. But James and I did see Guardians last week. We saw it Wednesday night, so it wasn't ready for press time. We had fun. Most of my friends, you know, gave this five bangers. They were sobbing uncontrollably into their pretzels, their pretzels and cheese, their popcorn. James and I had fun. I wasn't sobbing necessarily, but also we're kind of out of the loop. We're not like hardcore MCU watchers like most, I guess, people are these days. So we had fun. It was good. Good send off, I thought.
Yeah, you got to commit. I haven't watched any of the I watched like the first couple shows, but then stopped watching the shows. I haven't seen the last couple of movies, but I mean, Guardians, highest rated. What am I not going to watch it? I got to check that out, see what's up.
Can't wait for the mid-review of Guardians 3 from Mitchell in a month's time. Also, Air is out on video on demand this Friday. Ben Affleck,
Matt Damon, my boys,
they're out on video on demand. What about you? What do you want to spotlight?
Some have said we are the Ben Affleck and Matt Damon of the podcasting community.
Yes.
I wanted to shout out, you know, the Letterboxd show 4 faves The mainstay, it's back.
Mm.
You and Gemma on the first app a couple weeks ago talked to Ariel Barrera about how to blow up a pipeline. Me and Gemma this week talked to Emilio Estevez.
Nuts.
Big man. Breakfast Club, Repo Man, Mission Impossible. What can't this guy do?
What a get. What a conversation. Great conversation you both had. Very fun.
Thank you very much. I appreciate all of the editing, cutting out all of the bad things that I said, all of the things that could have gotten me canceled, anything questionable removed gracefully by Slim in the edit. But yeah, I mean, if people want to check that out, I thought it was a really lovely conversation. We got into a lot of his like overall career and his favorite movies. He talked a lot about Apocalypse Now, which he was on mm-hmm. set with his father way back in the day. And he talked primarily about his film, The Way, that he wrote and directed and had a, you know, supporting role in that his dad stars in. That's coming out in theaters for one day only, May 16th.
Wow. Fathom
Events. So if you want to check that out, Fathom Events, big ups.
The one interesting aspect of that conversation was there's, you know, Emilio was very funny in that conversation. He brought up Free Jack a few times and referenced movies that he regrets doing or like doesn't hold them up to the same esteem as obviously other ones. But I would love to hear a conversation with Emilio talk longer form about those movies that maybe in his view, maybe at the time or later weren't at the higher echelon, but have, you know, become cultish faves. Because I have so many friends and just like you, would jump at the chance to get like a steelbook of some of those movies that maybe Emilio doesn't love. And I'd love to have like a, just hear how he thinks about that kind of stuff. We didn't have the time in that episode necessarily while talking about his four faves, but it might be interesting to hear.
Yeah, that's like my favorite stuff to talk about, especially with people who have been in the business for a while. Like the ones that aren't like we didn't really get into The Breakfast Club because like, why would we, you know, like people, The Breakfast Club didn't talk about like so much over the years, but like getting to talk, I mean, Repo Man has like a cult classic status, so it has been talked about a decent amount, but like getting into that a little bit more, one that I wanted to bring up that I didn't get the chance to was Judgment Night, this like 1993 movie with him and Cuba Gooding Jr. and Jeremy Piven that like I really love. I think it's a great time that like I never see anybody talking about. It didn't even have a Letterboxd backdrop until on the Letterboxd page until a couple weeks ago. I added one on there. And like that's one that I really wanted to bring up, but just, you know, like you said, yeah, we're trying to get in and talk about his faves, his movie. Didn't get the chance to bring it up, but I would love to talk to him for an hour and a half about Judgment Night and see what he thinks.
Let's see. Judgment Night with no E, by the way, 1993.
October 15th.
We could do a 30th anniversary interview with Emilio. Emilio, come on down. Come back.
Come back.
October. Judgment Night conversation.
Me and you talking for half an hour about Judgment Night.
One other thing. Let's see. We have What's Love Got to Do with It? 2.9 average, dropped last week. Chile 76, 3.5. One Ranger, 2.6. Thomas Jane as the sheriff in London. We'll stay tuned for my own rating for that one. Okay, folks? We'll
that is there. Right around my beloved Pope's Exorcist 2.7 average.
Dang, it's under Pope's Exorcist. I actually tried to talk my wife into watching Pope's Exorcist, and she almost eye-rolled into a stroke.
The big reason I haven't watched it yet is because I know I'm going to need to watch it at like 3 o'clock in the morning in the dead of night.
All right, so let's move to the top 50 of 2023. Jack Moulton puts these big lists together for Letterboxd. He runs the whole show there, and this one will spotlight as the top 50 of the year, so it's updated weekly. Jack writes in the comments. He gives an update on the movies that leave the list, that enter the list, so these are the highest rated of the year so far. So Jack writes, a low-key update this week. I see How to Blow Up a Pipeline has moved down from the top 10 to 14 upon its VOD release, and Blackberry, Mitchell's movie of the year, has moved up from 40 to 34 ahead of its theatrical release.
That's your rating, bud. That 4-star from Slim bumped it up.
I did. I'm making an impact. Two new additions towards the bottom, French comedy Junkyard Dog at 46 and crime thriller To Catch a Killer at 47, which is the English language debut from Argentine director Damien Chiffron and his first film since the acclaimed Wild Tales from 2014. So a lot of moves, a lot of shakes.
A lot of moving and shaking. Scream 6, out of the list. Not in there anymore. Sorry, Ghostface.
RIP. RIP Ghostface.
let's move into the final section of our episode. I would say our favorite section. Let's be real.
Sure.
Everybody's favorite. Big hit. The weekend watch list shuffle. You, last week with Mia, you pulled The Parallax View, Alan J. Pakula thriller from the 70s. What'd you think?
Big, big, big get. It's been on my radar for so many years, mainly because of the poster, Warren Beatty 70s movie.
Sweet.
I liked it a lot.
Poster.
Liked it a lot. Warren Beatty's hair, my God. I want to launch a full investigation of that head of hair. So we mentioned it last week, but it was about him, Warren Beatty, stumbling upon a sort of shadowy group that assassinates politicians because an ex of his was near one of those assassinations. And then that's how the movie starts out. You see this assassination and then like years pass and she frantically reaches out to Warren that like something is going on. People around me are dying. They were all the people that were there and I could be next. And he kind of blows it off. And then the next day he's like at the morgue identifying her body. So he kind of feels like the guilt of that. So he's kind of just trying to figure out like, is this legit? Is there something actually going on here? And he stumbles into some more shady people over the course of the investigation. So it has gorgeous photography, the architecture, the way the shots are composed. It's beautiful. Are the 70s the best decade in film? Is this true?
There may be. I mean, I'll say I'm a big 80s head. If anybody knows anything about me, it's probably not a surprise that I'm a big like 80s person, but the 70s are definitely a jam. The 70s, like the run of conspiracy, like paranoia thrillers in the 70s, like that is like one like pocket of subgenre that is like my favorite thing. And like The Conversation, Marathon Man, The Parallax View, obviously, like those kind of movies. I could watch one of those 3 days of The Condor. I could watch one of those like every single day. I love that. That run is so sweet.
There was one scene I'll spot, last thing I'll say about the movie. I gave it 4 stars. During the course of the movie, he sneaks onto an airplane. He like sees someone that he recognizes. He follows them onto a plane and he sits down and the stewardess is like, you know, asking for people's tickets. He doesn't have one. He pays cash for a ticket on the plane. What? Like, this is like a whole different universe. You could walk onto a plane, sit down, pay $60 for a plane ticket. And
it's
then
like watching a Twilight Zone episode.
It is. It didn't make any sense to me. My brain was melting watching it. What about you? What did you watch?
So I got the film Crimes of Passion, the Ken Russell movie. Ken Russell, director of movies like The Devils and Tommy.
Ooh,
Crimes of Passion stars Kathleen Turner as a woman who is a fashion designer by day and a sex worker by night. That classic. Sorry. Story as old as time. Uh-huh. I thought it was a blast. It's I wrote in my review that it's a hoot and a holler. I struggled maybe a little bit like at the end with like some of its messaging around the sort of like hooker with a heart of gold who really just needs someone to love her. Like she's lonely and really just looking for love kind of archetype. Mm-hmm. And where like there's a central marriage kind of not with her, but with another character who starts like investigating like he starts working for like the fashion design company that she works for because there's been some moling going around and he has to like investigate her and inevitably he falls in love with her, et cetera. There's like a marriage relationship there with him and Annie Potts plays his wife. And some of the messaging around that, I wasn't sure like exactly where some of this was ending up, but I had a really great time with it. Like I loved everyone's performance in this. John Laughlin is the guy who plays that guy who's like investigating and he's like a perfect, like total like dunce, like an absolute putz. And he doesn't act in it. He keeps talking about like doing these like magic acts and his wife is always like, no, no more magic. Please don't do magic. And then him and his like dweeby friends are like wanting to do this thing that he calls the HP. And you're like, what's it? What's the HP? What's the HP? And then he comes out and the HP is what he calls the human penis. And he does this performance and it is mortifying. It's really tough to watch and you understand why. Maybe his wife hasn't wanted to have sex with him in a few years.
Oh
and
my God.
Maybe there's some good reasons why. But I mean, he's great. Annie Potts brings like so much humanity and screen presence. I love Annie Potts. Kathleen Turner at the center is like absolutely obliterating every moment of this. She leans like full tilt into every like lurid, sweaty, bloody, pulsating vein of Ken Russell's debaucherous mind.
Yeah.
And Anthony Perkins plays this like full gonzo, like nuts priest, like an absolute psychopath. And he's a blast. I mean, it's Anthony Perkins doing, like if you see Anthony Perkins in Psycho, this is him going like, taking that, going like 9 steps further the bizarre. It's a really wild movie. The Arrow Blu-ray menu for it is just this montage from the middle of the movie of two characters having sex, and it's like silhouetted with like the like craziest score and like these pink, it's like bisexual lighting, like pink and blue, like silhouetting on like the wallpaper. It's like, it definitely gives you a vibe of what you're going to get with the movie. It's a lot of fun.
God. Have you ever seen Kathleen Turner in Serial Mom?
I haven't, but when I interviewed Aubrey Plaza last year and asked her four favorite movies, Serial Mom is one of the movies that she mentioned as one of her four favorites.
Oh God.
I got to check that movie out.
Serial Mom, John Waters movie with Kathleen Turner. I saw that when I was maybe like, I guess 12 or 13, and it warped me. I had like weird memories of this movie. But yeah, I watched it recently in the last couple of years and I had a lot of fun. All right, some spotlighting of community reviews tagged Weekend Watch List. What a surprise. Aeon watched The Pope's Exorcist.
Whoa.
With a potential 199 sequels, that's going to be one hell of a box set.
I want to pick
Pope's
it up.
Exorcist. Stay tuned.
Aeon, two stars on that review, though. Let's switch that rating. We got to get that 2.7 up. I'll shout out Trip Wash Single White Female. The definition of they don't make it like this anymore. The languid pacing, the production design, the casting of Stephen Tobolowsky as Uber Creep, but also somehow overstays its welcome by half an hour. I'll mention Trip, a good dear friend of mine, one of my best buds. Trip texted me while watching Single White Female and told me that Stephen Tobolowsky plays a character named Mitch in the movie, and now reading that his character is an Uber Creep. Listen, Sam and I watched The Devil's Advocate over the weekend. A character named Mitch arrives in that movie at like it's a long movie. He arrives at like the 2-hour mark. This guy comes in, he's like, my name is Mitch. Within 5 seconds, this dude's getting hit, railroaded by a car in the middle of traffic, dead. He comes in, he's like, my name is Mitch. He gets hit by a car and he's dead. We got to talk about what's going on with characters named Mitch in movies.
Mitch. Old Mitch. Rest in peace. Another rip. Scream 6 and Mitch. Rip. Angelina Jo Reid watched Evil Dead Rise. Deliciously gross and gnarly with a sprinkling of the Raimi's slapstick energy as a little treat. Really hope they just keep churning these out in different settings every other year. Give me an Evil Dead movie set in an Amish community. In space. In the Fast and the Furious franchise. F it, let's go to Philly. Dead by John. Dead by John.
Philly.
My buddies have a t-shirt company. They have a John of the Dead t-shirt.
Oh, so wow. Oh,
that one's pretty
good.
That's
smart. Honestly, that's creative. Evil Dead Rise on VOD now, if you want to check that out. One last review I want to shout out. I have to do it.
Please.
Greatest movie of all time. Robert watched After Hours. Number one, everybody's favorite movie. Robert says that it manages to be really profound in the middle of all the goofy, fun, nightmare shit. Marty doesn't miss. That's right, Robert. Some would say After Hours is the greatest movie ever made.
Some would say.
Some
those
would
named
say.
Mitch, I would imagine.
Some would say.
We need to shuffle again. Let's head to our watch list. Let's set the stage for the next movie we'll watch. I am going to filter by stream only on my watch list. I'm a pro member and up. I can do that. And then I'm going to sort by shuffle. And the first movie I get, hell yeah. I've kept this one on my, even though the great culling of 2023 of my watch list happened, I kept this one on there because of the poster. 1988, directed by William Wesley, Scarecrows. It's a picture of an evil looking scarecrow. It's on Tubi, as you would imagine. So I'm excited to watch. I'm not going to read the description. It's evil scarecrows on Tubi. 2.7 average.
Wow.
Admittedly.
I love that you called your watch list to have like 70 movies and One Ranger is one of the movies. So
they can't all be winners, okay?
My watch list shuffle, a big one, a very big. I'm going back to 1955, Ordet, Carl Theodor Dreyer. I'll read the synopsis for this one. The three sons of devout Danish farmer Morten have widely disparate religious beliefs. The youngest son, Anders, shares his father's religion, but eldest son, Mikkel, has lost his faith, while middle child, Johan, has become delusional and proclaims that he is Jesus Christ himself. You can't do that, Johan. When Mikkel's wife, Inger, goes into a difficult childbirth, everyone's beliefs are put to the test. This is a big one. I love Paul Schrader. Paul Schrader, adore. This is one of his favorite movies of all time. He writes about it in his book, Transcendental Style in Film, which is one of my favorite film books. And so this has been on my watch list for a very long time. I'm excited to check it out. It's a shame I haven't watched it until now. So we're correcting it, people.
Which movie's going to be better, that or Scarecrows? We'll find out next time.
We'll find out. The people are asking. We'll see.
Thanks so much for listening to Weekend Watchlist, brought to you by The Letterboxd Show. You can follow Mitchell, Mia, Slim, that's me, and our HQ page on Letterboxd using the links in the episode notes. And if you have the time, maybe rate the pod on Apple or Spotify to help spread the word about the show.
Thanks to our crew, and thanks to Letterboxd member Trent Wallen for the theme music, Eyes On. Thanks to Jack for the facts and Sophie Shin for the episode transcript. And to you for listening. Weekend Watchlist is a Tape Deck production.
This is a Tape Deck podcast.